The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You might assume that in order to find these guys, you'd have to navigate onto the dark net or find some shady middleman somewhere. But in many cases, we saw that the clients would be found on LinkedIn. The Indian hackers would trawl LinkedIn for private investigators, send them direct messages to the effect of, hey, do you need some cyber investigation help? Rarely was it described openly as hacking, but you know, private investigators that we spoke to said that they all immediately understood the kinds of services that were on offer. And the Indians would proceed in that way, messaging hundreds and hundreds of private investigators all across the world, just directly on LinkedIn, cold calling them.
I'm Alvaro Marañón, fellow in cybersecurity law at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 12th, 2022. The hackers for hire industry continues to grow unbothered. Reports in recent years have uncovered details about governments and officials using spyware and other security and privacy circumventing tools to target both dissidents and other sensitive targets. But another equally invasive and secretive industry has developed over the last decade, involving the use of foreign hackers to win lawsuits and arbitration battles. I sat down with Chris Bing and Raphael Satter. Chris is a reporter for Reuters covering digital espionage, and Raphael is a journalist and writer for Reuters covering cybersecurity. Chris and Raphael recently published an extensive investigation titled How Mercenary Hackers Sway Litigation Battles, where they break down this hackers for hire business model in India. We discuss the details around the structure of this marketplace, the tactics, techniques, and procedures used by the various hacking groups, and what the significance of this illicit industry could be for other sensitive communities. It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 12th, How Mercenary Hackers Sway Litigation Battles. The rise of the hackers for hire industry has been reported in past years and predominantly occurred within the context of government interest, as in governments have been the ones employing these firms and operators to hack dissidents and other sensitive targets. But your investigation here is about an entirely different market with different players and motives. Can you speak about what sparked this initial investigation?
So our investigation really began in 2018 when we heard about a report that was being produced by Citizen Lab about an Indian hacker for hire firm that was targeting a group of environmental activists who had been campaigning against ExxonMobil amid a litigation battle. And we were interested in this topic because we had rarely heard about environmentalists being targeted and we wanted to learn more. Years earlier, we had been tracking and trying to learn more about different mercenary hacking organizations. We had heard there was a number of them in India, but we never had something very concrete to go after. So this Citizen Lab report, which came out, I believe, in 2020, known as Dark Basin, was kind of a jumping off point for us.
And following then, what indications have you gotten or developments have you seen that there was things missing from this initial investigation, as in there's a larger ecosystem here at play?
I think what we realized was that this is an industry that has a long history dating back to at least 2010. And there was one company which we discuss in our story known as Appen where many of these hackers had worked for and had been trained. And what we learned through our investigation is that Appen had a business where it would sell hacking services to private detectives and other clients who would then use those hacking services in order to win litigation battles. The private eyes would be hired by wealthy clients, and then they would hack litigants on the other side of a dispute in order to gain an advantage, in order to steal privileged information. And this was a business model that had existed for a decade. And as professionals that worked at Appen left the company, they started their own businesses. And so it sort of spawned an entire industry. One of the companies we talk about in our story, Beltrox, the same company that was first revealed by Citizen Lab, was one of those companies, one of those alumni companies that started from that network.
Yeah, Beltrox has been quite active. I know you cite two investigations into their dealings. Can you speak a bit about the particular players and the infamous Gupta?
Yeah, so Sumeet Gupta is a young Indian computer security expert. He first came up on the radar in 2015 through an indictment in the Northern District of California, where two private detectives were hired in what was essentially a multi-level marketing dispute between two multi-level marketing companies. And Gupta was hired by a PI in that case to hack one side. And so he was publicly charged, indicted, but never apprehended or captured or brought back to the United States. And so this is when his name kind of first appears in public. Fast forward years later, and he's still running a hacking company, which is Beltrox, and he's serving the same type of clients involved in similar style disputes without much break or pause or issue. And so Gupta was kind of one of these Appen alumni that we discuss in our story, who, you know, really saw a business by selling services to Western private eyes and by hacking litigants.
And from here, can you speak about how you came across this really rich trove of this database you described, this hacker's hit list? It has tremendous detail. I guess, Raphael, could you start?
Yeah, I can cover some of that. The hacker hit list was enormous. It's about 80,000 lines of information, and we stumbled upon it after trying to figure out how it was that these hackers were doing their jobs. Right, you know, every hacker, every group of hackers has their own specific techniques, and one of the things that you try to figure out as an investigator is, you know, how do the guys pull off what they pull off? And are there any kind of vulnerabilities that enabled us to see what they're doing? And while we can't say specifically, you know, who it was who supplied us with their data, we can speak in general terms. And one of the things that we noticed is that these hackers were very, very cost conscious. They were very interested in using free services to carry out their activities. And the old saw about free services is true, is that if you're not paying for it, then you are the product. And that was true of some of these email services that the hackers were using. So the hackers, for example, were very interested in tracking their emails to see whether or not their victims were opening their phishing messages. And there are services around the internet that allow you to do that. They're called email tracking services. They were also interested in anonymizing the messages that they sent. And again, you know, all over the internet, there are services that allow you to do that. And so we zeroed in on some of these services, and we knocked on several doors to try to get help. And in some cases, we were successful. In other cases, we were unsuccessful. But in the cases in which we were successful, the people who ran these services were able to uncover a huge trove of data about when exactly these hackers were active, who they were active against, and most interestingly, from our point of view, how they were carrying about their attacks. So we could see, for example, in some cases, the actual subject lines that the hackers were using to try to entice their targets to click. And that gave us a lot of insight into the nature of the dispute that these hackers were getting involved in. Because although some of the phishing was pretty generic, the kind of phishing that you or I would receive every day, you know, click here to, you know, to see a message on Facebook, that kind of stuff. Other stuff was very targeted and actually referred to the relevant lawsuits in the subject line itself. So that gave us a huge amount of insight. And then we faced the task of, well, you know, what do we do with this data? And here I might hand it over to Chris.
Yeah, just two quick questions regarding this hackers list. One, how did you go about the verification of the authenticity with this list? I know there's a lot of barriers here that you guys went through. And in the second part, you speak a little bit about the more tailored aspect. Was this generally a trend within the larger ecosystem in India, or was it just particular firms that were, I guess, investing more into this human engineering?
So the list, when we received this data, which was, as Raphael put it, kind of a hacker hit list, it showed us all of the outbound phishing that these Indian hackers were doing towards targets. We had to organize it and sort of make it make sense to us, which was a little bit of like a data science challenge. We had help from a colleague in London who was hugely helpful to us to organize it all. But we still had the issue of basically a giant stack of hay that didn't really make a lot of sense. And what the data offered us was a story, but one that was obfuscated. We needed to be cleaned up, needed to be better understood. And a challenge there also was ensuring that that data was accurate, that this data indeed showed Indian hacker for hire activity. In order to do that, there's only really a few companies around the world that could look at a data set like this and say, okay, you know, we've seen this stuff before, or we've seen this stuff on our email platforms, and we can confirm to you it's real, it's legit. And those companies are the companies that we ultimately approached and were really gracious enough to help us work through this. And those companies included Microsoft and Google, as well as several cyber threat intelligence companies that have a history of tracking Indian hackers, including Mandiant, BAE, and others. And so they were able to actually look at the phishing, the IP addresses associated with the phishes, the sender accounts, the exact date and times when they were being able to send, and then look at that same activity on their own platforms and say, yep, this matches up with what we're seeing. And that's how we were able to authenticate it. The second part of it, though, in order to make sense of it all, was a very time-intensive process of reaching out to every victim in the data set, all 13,000, with the simple question, do you remember this phishing email? Did you get hacked? Is this time important to you? Because remember, the data provided us with the date and the time that they were getting sent to phish. And over and over and over again, Raphael and I were just really struck that when we contacted the targets, they would say, you know, it's funny you mentioned that date. I was about to launch this this lawsuit against a business partner of mine. Or, I was in the middle of this lawsuit with my wife, or with my former business partner, or with this company I was trying to acquire. And so it always seemed that when we spoke to victims that were in this data set, that the timing stood out for them. They could understand it. And the other thing that helped was that once we told them when the phishes occurred, when they were being sent the hacking attempts, they could check their own inbox as long as they had some retention rules on their inboxes, and they could verify for themselves that we were telling them the truth, that they had indeed received these hacking attempts at that time. So that always made the conversation much easier, is when they were able to self-validate they had received that phishing email. And then in some cases, the people who had received the phishing email and then could find it would in some cases forward it to us. And then we could actually look at the malicious link they had been sent that back to a cybersecurity researcher, a source who could then analyze it again. And so there was a lot of like kind of nitty gritty on the back end, but the project really flourished through these thousands, hundreds of interviews that we did, where people told us their stories and explained to us why this timing mattered. And that was supported then by interviews that we did with several of these Indian hackers who told us, you know, directly that they would often be hired amid litigation battles. and that they could charge thousands or tens of thousands of dollars in order to get into these inboxes for their clients.
And speaking about their clientele, how did they go about finding clients? Did they have to rely on intermediaries? Did they, you know, as we see with other cybercrime, rely on online illicit forums, or was it something different?
I think one of the things that struck us as we were digging into this, Alvaro, is that just how low-tech the pitching process was. You know, you might assume that in order to find these guys, you'd have to navigate onto the dark net or find some shady middleman somewhere. And, you know, it's possible that that happened in some cases. And definitely there are a lot of middlemen involved in this industry. But in many cases, we saw that the clients would be found on LinkedIn. The Indian hackers would trawl LinkedIn for private investigators, send them direct messages to the effect of, hey, do you need some cyber investigation help? Rarely was it described openly as hacking, but you know, private investigators that we spoke to said that they all immediately understood the kinds of services that were on offer. And the Indians would proceed in that way, messaging hundreds and hundreds of private investigators all across the world, just directly on LinkedIn, cold calling them. And that's how some of the, that's at least how some of the clientele got connected with Indian hackers. That is, for example, we open with a case in California involving a private investigator who used to work for Blackwater and who had set up in Silicon Valley. You know, he doesn't remember exactly how it is that he found the hackers, but it was either on LinkedIn or through some sort of online advertisement, very, very much in the open. Later on, as the industry matured, we've seen evidence that there's a network of established middlemen that funnel wealthy clients towards these hackers. Because for the ultra wealthy clients, those aren't the kinds of people who spend a lot of time on LinkedIn fielding cold calls. You know, they have, there are layers of people that they go through. But eventually all of it comes down to a private investigator communicating over Skype or LinkedIn with some of these Indian hackers. And that was, it's kind of humorous to see how that happened.
Yeah, that is quite surprising how open they are compared to other types of cyber crimes where they set up various barriers. But I guess that kind of goes back to the, I guess you say, the common characteristics with the infrastructure and techniques used by these hackers for hire. They often replicate or use existing infrastructure. That's correct?
Yeah, that's right. All of it is very low tech and low effort. I mean, you know, that's in part why we were able to get such amazing data on their activities, is that they were pretty sloppy and they were pretty complacent about using free and open services. That kind of goes against the grain of what you might think these hackers, or how you might think these hackers behave, which is, you know, in a kind of very ultra sophisticated, stealthy way. They were involved in a pretty low effort activity.
And speaking, if you could speak about a particular instance of one of these investigations and how one of these emails proved to be a smoking gun. I know you spoke about a WeWork incident and also a lawsuit with the Nigerian government. Either would be great.
Yeah, I can speak to the Nigerian example a little bit, in part because it was almost forehead slapping how the incident took place. It was in the context of an arbitration battle between the Nigerian government and the family of an Italian investor. They were arguing over the rights to a block of oil fields and a company called Pan Ocean, which the Italian family had lost control of. And in the middle of the case, someone emails the tribunal with confidential documents from the Nigerian government side. And there's no real explanation in the email for where these documents come from. It just says, the real truth about Pan Ocean. And the email appears to come from a lawyer for the Nigerian government, which is particularly puzzling because, you know, why would a lawyer for the Nigerian government be sending the tribunal confidential documents from his own side? It was almost as if the lawyer had gone rogue and decided to throw his own clients under the bus. And we spoke to the lawyer involved, a guy named Oluwasina Ogunbare, and what
Oluwaseina told us is that he had nothing to do with the email. Somebody had stolen these documents from his side, had impersonated him in an email, and then sent that email to the arbitrators at the tribunal. And that, you know, it just, you know, he was completely puzzled by how this worked, because for him, it didn't pass the smell test. Even if you thought that he had sent it accidentally, it just didn't really make sense. So, to his surprise, the tribunal actually accepted the documents, albeit with some caveats. And there was some concern that they would rely on the documents for their judgment. In the end, that didn't happen, but it was still an example of how brazen these kinds of hacks can be, because, you know, you might expect there to be some sort of explanation for how these documents were obtained. And there wasn't in this case. In the end, we found the explanation, because we found that Ogunbare, and indeed many of his colleagues in Nigeria, had been on this hacker hit list. And in fact, they'd been targeted by these Beltrox hackers only a couple of months before this mysterious email landed inside the tribunal's inbox. So that gave us sort of an explanation of what took place there. Like a lot of crimes, hacking is relatively easy to do, but being able to launder the information is a little bit more difficult. And that's where we see these hackers fail time and time again. They're able to get this information, which can be very useful to their client, but they often don't have a particularly plausible explanation for how they got the data, and therefore find it relatively difficult or relatively more difficult to launder it into the court system.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay.
And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before DeleteMe started advertising with Lawfare. DeleteMe finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then DeleteMe comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. DeleteMe sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate DeleteMe, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
And speaking of this attempted laundering, your investigation highlights around 35 cases from the past decade or so. Can you speak a bit about the breadth of the companies involved? And in particular, it was a bit interesting. There was no real particular industry that was focused. Generally, you would think it's kind of high stakes, but it went from beverage companies to environmental to NGOs, correct?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, we can't get into the details of each case, but the breadth, you're right about the breadth. So we did speak to people who were in divorce cases, right? You know, that's about as personal as it can get. In the Nigerian case, you're talking about an arbitration battle which was valued at $1.5 billion. You know, that was the amount of the damages that they were seeking. So it really ran the gamut. And no, there wasn't a particular pattern to the industry. We've seen it all over, from energy to real estate to retail, you name it.
And in the past, the FBI and other agencies have been closing in on this Indian market for cyber hackers for hire, but they've never really pieced it all together. And you particularly speak in your investigation, both of you speak about how you were able to trace the money and the extent of this. Can you speak a little bit about the details of what you uncovered?
Yeah, I think that you're probably thinking about the Farhad Azima case, which we mentioned. That was an unusual case and remains an unusual case, in that one of the victim party has been able to allegedly trace back the money all the way from the client through the private investigators to the hackers, and they did it through several ways. One is that we got in touch with them to tell them that they'd been targeted by Indian hackers, so they had that to go on. And then they hired their own private investigators who were able to fill in some of the blanks in our own understanding of what happened. And according to them, what took place was that Farhad Azima, who's a U.S. Aviation executive, got into a business dispute with an investment agency based in the United Arab Emirates. And then his emails were hacked. They were leaked online. And those emails appeared to show him plotting against his business partner. His business partner then sued, and his business partner then won. Shortly thereafter, we get in touch and we tell him, hey, did you know that you were targeted by Indian hackers? He then hires these PIs, And these PIs are able to find out that these Indian hackers were paid $1 million by a U.S. private investigator. That U.S. private investigator at the time was working for a major U.S. law firm called Deckert. And at the time, Deckert was representing his former business partner. And that completed the chain. Now that, you know, that case is still being litigated. You know, I'd be very curious to see how it ends. But it's interesting to note that that former business partner, this investment agency based in the United Arab Emirates, has recently said that they are no longer defending the case, and they've effectively waved the white flag and offered to settle it. So I think we'll probably be seeing more information about that very soon.
No, absolutely. And I guess importantly, the pay there was quite high for the Indian hackers. What typically or how costly is it for a client to target someone or employ these services? I know the retainers range, but generally, is it quite costly?
So one way to think about this is that at each step in the chain, someone is taking a cut, and it's larger as it gets closer to the client. And so the client will pay a private detective, in usually a retainer per month, of tens of thousands of dollars or up to several hundreds of thousands of dollars per month. That private detective will then hire the Indian hackers, and the Indians are often paid either per target or per job. And they will be given a certain amount of money based on which target has more priority. So there was a question about the range and sophistication for the phishing emails they sent, because in some cases they almost looked like spam, and in other cases they were so well tailored, it was like they'd been spying on that person physically for months. They knew what cases they were working on, what legal cases, who their business partners were, the names of their family members, what sports clubs they were into, where they volunteered, and they'd craft their phishing emails with this information, and it showed a higher priority. And so in some cases for non-priority hacking targets, what we were told is it could range from a few thousand dollars, but higher priority hacking targets, for clients, the Indian hackers could be paid somewhere in the range between 20 and 30,000 in order to turn over the email inbox content.
And to what extent were the clientele repeat customers, or were they often just one-off requests?
We believe that ultimately this is a fairly small community of middlemen who work with the Indian hackers, who then turn those capabilities and those services out to a larger network of clients. So the people who are really connecting the Indian hackers to Western faces, to Western businesses, is, you know, a group of maybe under 100 private detectives and other types of middlemen. But in the end, the larger network of clients is probably much larger. As we were told by one former Beltrox executive, repeat business and repeat customers is how this whole industry works.
And it's crazy how long it's been going on, I guess, somewhat secretively. But I guess within certain circles, it's been kind of a known secret. And I guess following your investigation, there have been a lot of victim companies that have spoken up or speaking out, launching their own types of actions. Can you speak a little bit about of what type of remedial actions they sought? Was it simply civil damages, or did they just want some type of attribution?
I think it's probably a mixture of both in terms of the victims. There's a great desire on behalf of people who've lost litigation to try to see if there's some grounds for appeal. And in that respect, it's very important for them to figure out who targeted them and under what circumstances. Afterwards, you know, if it gets that far, there's the question of damages. And I think that, you know, in the Farhad Azima case that we just discussed, they've got to that stage now where there's negotiations over the size of a potential settlement.
And you also touched upon or cite the destruction of hacked data in this one Israeli court order, which is quite interesting. And you also highlight, I think recently tweeted about one NGO in India had some difficulties with their own investigation with law enforcement. And after that, we can speak a little bit about the themes of what role law enforcement plays here.
Yeah, I think that there is, you're probably referring to what's called an FIR in India. There was an Indian NGO whose name unfortunately escapes me at the moment, but they're a civil society group that focuses on internet freedom issues. And they filed a criminal complaint against Beltrox. And shortly before our story was published, they realized that that criminal complaint had been closed without explanation. And I don't know, you know, given that there was no explanation, I can't speculate as to why it was closed or whether any investigation happened. But it's interesting in the context of what Chris brought up earlier that the owner or co-owner of Beltrox, Sumit Gupta, has been a wanted man for years. And he's been on law enforcement's radar for the better part of a decade. And yet he was able to operate openly in Delhi. And even now, 2 years after the scale of Beltrox's operations have been exposed, we have no real understanding of what, if anything, Delhi police is doing to investigate Beltrox. And there are any number of reasons for that, but it's really interesting that Sumit, as far as we're aware, has not been arrested or charged.
Yeah, that's interesting. We've seen that in, again, the ransomware context, where in Russia, we often see the state acquiesce or, I guess, give their subtle approval of the various ransomware groups, launching their investigations or their campaigns. But do you see a shift in the U.S. and India's relationship here? Going forward, will this threat grow? And how do you think the U.S. might respond?
I think that's a really good question. And it's a very difficult question to answer. Through our investigation, we believe that the FBI and U.S. law enforcement has been aware of the Indian hacker for hire market and its impact on Americans, Europeans, litigation battles for just about as long as it's existed, for a decade. And in particular with Mr. Gupta, at least since 2015 with those charges. We would love to know what the conversation has been like between U.S. law enforcement and Indian law enforcement about this, and why there doesn't appear to really have been a hard crackdown on this activity over the years. But, you know, to what degree it's going to change Indian and U.S. relations, I think minorly, if at all, because of how long it's been going on. And, you know, these cases, hacking cases, are notoriously hard to bring by prosecutors. You have to prove that a specific person behind a computer at a specific time is responsible for this computer crime. So they can take years to develop and years to publicly come out. And so, you know, one case that we're closely monitoring that we'd like to turn listeners onto is this case involving a man named Aviram Azhari, who is in prison in New York. We discuss his case. He is an Israeli private detective who was arrested in New York several years ago while vacationing in the United States. And he had hired Indian hackers, specifically Beltrox, to hack targets that were all commonly critical and many of them had received legal threats from a German payments company known as Wirecard. The Wirecard story is this kind of insane, wild story about a quickly rising German tech company that has now fallen out of business and filed for insolvency, and whose CEO is in prison under fraud charges. And what we commonly saw was that Beltrox in our data was really hacking in great force critics, journalists, financial analyst, big New York hedge funds that had bet against Wirecard. And this Aviram Azhari private detective, his case is one that's coming to a conclusion finally. He pled guilty several months ago. In the charging documents by the Southern District of New York, they describe how this Indian hacking campaign has thousands of victims, and that they worked for clients in the United States and many other countries. And so they're clearly referring to a larger universe of both victims and clients that they know about. So you know, there could be more hammers that fall here throughout the rest of this year and next year, and what potential impact it has on U.S.-India relations is going to be hard to predict until we see that.
Looking at other fields to, I guess, learn, to draw learning lessons from, the human rights in particular has been quite familiar with these types of dangers of spyware, especially with Pegasus. So what does your investigation mean for those less familiar with this threat? You spoke about how those in the high-stake diet shake industry have been targeted and those with financial, I guess, developments or issues. But who else should be concerned or be, I guess, cautious of this?
You know, I think if you're in high-stakes litigation where you can assume that private detectives are being hired on both sides of the legal dispute, there's a possibility that downstream, somewhere in the contracting universe between these private detectives, a hacker gets involved and that they target your inbox, your cell phone. You know, the activity we talk about in our story is ultimately phishing. It's email phishing, something that's common, but still very effective. I think where this industry is going is in a more tailored, sophisticated cyber capabilities manner in which you could start to see things like phone hacking, 0 days on phones, because these litigation battles are worth, can be worth so much money. And a small piece of information, a piece of evidence that gets leaked online or that's able to be used to design the discovery strategy for one legal side is so valuable that you could potentially see hackers get involved. I think beyond legal disputes, where a lot of money is at stake, legal disputes that involve developing countries or countries where like cyber laws are not necessarily as established or places where hackers may be brought in. We saw a nexus in particular with like Eastern European oligarchs in cases involving Eastern European oligarchs, where if you were facing a legal battle with them, Beltrox, Appen, or another Indian company would kind of get involved. And it was hard to say, obviously, in some of those cases, like exactly who they were working for, what their intentions were, but it was the classic kind of case where these guys got involved. We did see some human rights targeting. It was a smaller group than like the larger target list, but we did see some of that. And we think, as we discussed in our story, that it's possible that these Indian hackers had a few government clients. So they actually kind of facilitated domestic intelligence collection efforts. And that's something that we're going to try and explore more in future reporting.
And I guess to end off, could you speak about the importance, if there is, and the motives and we see here in other types of cyber crimes investigations? Here, often they're financial motives by private players, but as you mentioned, they're beginning to target states and the public sector. Will that raise or accelerate some of these negotiations around changes in India?
You know, that assumes that there are negotiations around change, which I'm not 100% sure of. The use. You know, the entry of these private actors into state conflicts is something that that we've been watching. We've seen that all over the place. We've seen that, for example, in debates around Pegasus and NSO. We've seen that elsewhere. I don't know that we've reached a critical mass of concern where, you know, people are going to kind of stand up and take notice. That may change at some point, but you know, I don't see a huge amount of concern at the international level about the operations of these kinds of hack for hire firms. There has been some as far as the Israeli companies NSO and Candira are concerned, but we have not yet seen that filter through to India. That may yet happen.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you, Raphael.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
The Lawford Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawford podcasts by becoming a Lawford material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcast. Look out for other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter,
and our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th, the aftermath. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. You can also buy Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schellen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.